Welcome to the New Books Network.
This podcast episode was made possible in part with support from Sacred Rights, a project funded by the Henry Luce Foundation and the E. Rhodes and Leona B. Carpenter Foundation and hosted by Northeastern University. Sacred Rights is a project that supports public scholarship on religion and provides resources and networks for scholars of religion committed to translating the significance of their research to a broader audience. I recommend you learn more about Sacred Rights on their website at sacred-rights.org or find Sacred Rights on Twitter at sacred_rights. Welcome to Classical Ideas. This is Greg Soden, and this is a podcast where, since 2017, I discuss all things religion with a variety of fantastic scholars, experts, authors, and educators. On this episode, I speak with Dr. Sarah Mosliner. Sarah Mosliner is a lecturer in the Department of Philosophy, Anthropology, and Religion at Central Michigan University, where she teaches courses on the history of religious and racial discrimination in the United States. She has been studying evangelical purity culture and has numerous publications, including the book Virgin Nation, Sexual Purity, and American Adolescence from Oxford University Press. She has appeared on numerous podcasts and is a regular contributor to the podcast Straight White American Jesus. This is a really fun and wide-ranging conversation with a little bit of everything from discussions on the book Virgin Nation to Dr. Mosliner's work with the After Purity Project. I really hope you enjoy our conversation. Dr. Sarah Mosliner, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining me today.
I am so happy to be here. Looking forward to our conversation.
As am I. I am so happy that you're here too. And I'm wondering if you can just spend a minute and introduce yourself a little bit to the audience and the listeners out there so they know a little bit about who you are and what you do.
My day job, I guess you could say, is I am a lecturer in the Department of Philosophy, Anthropology, and Religion at Central Michigan University, which is in Mount Pleasant, Michigan, which is also the home of the Saginaw Chippewa Indian tribe and the ancestral home of the Anishinaabeg people. One of the things we do at CMU is we always include a land acknowledgement because we have a relationship with the local tribe and, you know, and we are on their land. And this is controversial and something I talk about every semester, but since the 1940s, we have been the Chippewas. And so that creates an opening for us to have that conversation. What does that mean? What is this history, right? What does it mean that it was used for decades without permission and so on and so forth? So that is where I am from geographically. I am also, I call myself the director of the After Purity Project, which just makes it sound much more fancy, but it's really been my research project for the last several years, where I've been interviewing people who have grown up and out of evangelical purity culture. And this work has introduced me to topics I never imagined I would be spending time with, and that is topics like religious trauma, sexual abuse, and sort of all of the emotional and psychological labor that people have to go through when they leave a sort of a very conservative, tight-knit religious community. So that's where my brain lives.
I love it. Well, I want to know a little bit about your pathway into your current work. You have a pretty interesting bio. I was on your website and reading about you on the Sacred Rights website as well. And I want to know a little bit about your backstory to kind of set the stage for where your scholarship is today. Mm-hmm. You have a title on your website that really grabbed my attention called From Pure Adolescence to Promiscuous Scholarship. So I'm wondering if you can just tell me a little bit about your pathway, maybe from like your youth and then into some important academic, you know, turning points within your journey.
Yeah, Okay, so to start from the beginning, I was raised in white evangelicalism, a very Calvinist form in the Midwest and Western Pennsylvania. So a much more intellectual and less populist form of evangelicalism, right? Today, I think much of what we see in evangelicalism is very populist, right? Mine was a little more subdued. But there was also this notion that education and thinking about, even about, especially about your faith, right, that that was part of being a Christian. So I didn't grow up with a lot of anti-intellectualism that I have heard from a lot of other people who were raised evangelical. And I think that for me, right, in many ways, that saved me from a lot because it gave me a place to go when I needed to go. But, you know, as a teenager, I was, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, I was very kind of caught up in sort of the what felt to me like the growing vitality of evangelicalism. My high school, my Christian school, was very much part of the pro-life movement. We went to the March for Life every year as a school trip my senior year. I organized that trip. Also, my senior year, I wrote a letter to the editor in response to a news story about teaching abstinence-only education. And there were sex educators in the public schools arguing that, oh, you can't teach abstinence-only education. That's just impractical, and so on and so forth. And I took great umbrage.
Yeah.
And said, it is practical because many of us are. So I basically said in an article, you know, in this letter to the editor that I am not, you know, I am a teenager that is not having sex. And that's because I'm a Christian. And maybe you all should think about that too. Right. Mm-hmm. So it was very, very haughty, very whatever. Well, I had no memory of that letter until after I published my first book, Evangelical Purity Culture. And it was like the summer that book came out, 2015, that I said to myself, yeah, I wonder if I could find that letter online somewhere. And lo and behold, I did. And
wow.
I think that's on my website. You can see.
It is. I read it. Yeah.
Yes. Right. So that.
Yeah, I read it.
Yeah. So you can go to sarahmosslener.com and read this letter that I wrote. And I was just like, so I think and it's really interesting that I really had a block around it, you know, in terms of a memory. And then, you know, I went to college. I went to what was then at the time Calvin College, which for me was sort of from where I was coming from, was a very kind of big leap into this bigger, more exciting world. I studied theater as an undergrad, and that I did theater in college. Like, that was my life. And also, I think, right, it saved me as well, you know, from the more hardened parts of evangelicalism, and really how kind of challenge my habits of thinking in instructive ways that I think made me a better thinker and just a better person. My senior year of college, I was doing theater tech, right? Turned out I did not have the acting skills I thought I did. but I was really good at doing backstage stuff. I did a lot of stage management. I think my work was well respected, and that is, you know, and I eventually moved to Chicago in hopes of pursuing that. But before that, I was one of my professors contacted me and said, oh, a local church is having an event. They need someone to help them with some technical stuff. Turned out they didn't, but whatever, because I just sat there the whole time. But they were offering me $100, and I was like, I'll do it.
Yeah.
So I go, and I was at Calvary Baptist Church in Grand Rapids, which is still there. And so I went and I watched this event that turned out to be a True Love Waits event. And this was in 1995. And the difference between me at 17 writing that letter and me sitting in that church watching this event that was like one part rock concert, one part, you know, altar call, you know, one part, like intense sexual shame and fear. I was just like, what is this? And that stayed with me for a really long time. And I think was one of the reasons that, and being introduced to this thing called feminist theology, made me be like, this is where I need to get answers to these questions. And so that's where I, and from there I went to seminary, got a master's degree focusing on feminist and other liberation theologies, and then went on to get my PhD, having shifted my focus to the history of evangelicalism with an emphasis on gender, sexuality, and race. So by the time I get to really doing my research on purity culture, right, it was before we called it that. I can't claim responsibility for, it was Donna Freitas who coined the term evangelical purity culture. I think I called it the faith-based abstinence movement in my earlier work. But by that time, I had such different experiences and perspectives on it. So I went from being this very like self-righteous teenager to being a very horrified college student to wanting to be an academic, to say, okay, what are the tools I need to really make sense of what this is? And at that time, so this was 2006 is when I started my dissertation. There were no public voices pushing back on purity culture. At that point, I just wanted to understand it, right? And I wasn't even looking for opposition. I was looking, what does this mean to the people who participate in it? How can we make sense of this, sort of using all the fancy stuff that we have in religious studies, right? All the theories that we have, like what is really going on here? And later on, when the dissertation became a book, I realized that there was an argument about nationalism that that I had not seen doing my dissertation work. And so it was not just about, you know, horny teenagers in the backseat, right? That this was a movement that was intentionally political in order to allow white evangelicals to increase their political power and social influence. And, you know, and part of this larger, you know, conglomerate of policies and beliefs around sex, right? So it is sort of, I keep wanting to co-opt the term seamless garment from the Catholic Church, which doesn't, and I'm not totally comfortable with that, because I think there is some value and virtue in the seamless garment argument, because it's like, we are like, consistency is really important, but that's kind of right. It's sort of this whole conglomeration of responses to changes in gender roles, changes in norms around sexuality. And so purity culture is just another piece of that. Two weeks ago, I was at the University of Chicago Div School at a conference on religion and reproductive rights. And the person this is a topic I have a lot of blockages around, because of, you know, it's a topic in my family that is, yeah, that's really very difficult. And since the overturn of Roe v. Wade, I've sort of been like, you know, kind of walking through, or just feeling like I'm just kind of in a daze and trying to, like, and so much has been sort of opening up in me in terms of understanding kind of this on both a personal level, but on an intellectual. And you'll find, as you listen to me talk, like I'm increasingly unable, especially in a post-Roe world and a post-purity world, to divorce the personal from the intellectual for myself. Mm-hmm. And I've decided I'm not going to apologize for that anymore. Mm-hmm. So yes. So thinking about, you know, how the rhetoric of the pro-life movement is very much the rhetoric of, you know, this abstinence only purity culture stuff. And they play the same role in US politics. And now I think we see very clearly, right, that this has been intentional, right? Purity culture is a way to socialize young people into an understanding of what their future families should look like and that they should desire to have those particular families, right? Yeah. And those same people who are teaching this are also make the argument very successfully that, you know, the strength of the US nation state is in our white Christian families. Mm. And so that, and, you know, and so it's a real kind of ruse, I think, that's been perpetrated, not that a white Christian family in and of itself is a problem, but it's the symbol, right, of American goodness.
Yeah.
And it does a lot of things, including, you know, performing things like sexual, like it creates sort of a veil of sexual innocence, right? Or maybe, I don't know, maybe a screen is a better metaphor, right? The white Christian family is sort of this screen that you can project onto it things like sexual innocence and racial innocence. And that then is promoted as sort of as a national identity, right?
Gotcha. Yeah. Well, and I know that you mentioned your book a couple times, which came out in 2015, Virgin Nation, Sexual Purity and American Adolescence. What did you like about that process of adapting the dissertation into a book and then seeing that come into the world?
Yeah, I think, you know, I had a great advisor who taught me to think about finding a through line. And I really struggled with that with my dissertation. And I think in part because no one had written on, right, I was writing on a topic that no one had written on academically. There was one person and her book came out in 2011, I believe, which is good. It's called Making Chastity Sexy. And she was a professor at Wheaton at the time. So for anyone who likes to, you know, scratch down a bibliography during a podcast interview, Christine Carter's book, right? So hers was the first to come out. And you always learn like, oh, there's going to be other people studying what you study, you know, but I didn't have like a corpus of work to go to and say, oh, well, what's my contribution going to be? What's my unique? And so I really didn't know how to do the work of, okay, well, why is this important, right? Aside from understanding maybe a certain experience of adolescent spirituality, like what else matters here? And so when I was, I don't remember when this was, but I was looking back over my interview transcript with the president, the founder and CEO or whatever of Silver Ring Thing, which was one of the groups I studied, and in part because they're out of Pittsburgh, which is where I'm from. And so I had some connections, but they were also like True Love Waits. They had a national campaign. And in my interview with, his name was Denny Patton, he talked about, you know, holding a belief that that the end of the world is coming, that the United States is in a final stage of civilizational rise and decline that has been demonstrated in other historical contexts, especially the fall of Rome, and that the United States was sort of in a state of decay, and that eventually it will mean the end, right? So and all this to say, like, his primary concern was for saving kids, right? And that the purity, or the abstinence stuff was sort of the means to do that. And so I was, of course, very familiar with all the different pre and post-millennial theologies, but this was the first time I had heard it directly connected to purity or to abstinence. And I was like, okay, this is what we need to dig into. And so I started going back, I started working backwards to see where there were arguments about sexual immorality directly connected to the decline of the nation state. And I knew that was available, as many people do, in rhetoric around, you know, in the 1970s, we would have said homosexuality, right? That was, but I was more interested in this in sexual purity. And so I looked to see where people were sort of connecting sexual purity, and which specifically referred to not having sex outside of marriage, right? And that sex was about family building, and family building is about nation building, right? In this worldview. So I found that all over James Dobson. I found that all over Billy Graham. And I found it all over first wave feminism. Hmm. And so that was my through line, right?
Yeah.
Like, these are the places where we see this rhetoric showing up. And so I'm very interested in the work that rhetoric does. And so that's what I wrote about for Virgin Nation, to really show that this was that sexual purity was a concept that was created in the 19th century as part of white Protestant gender roles for the purpose of creating a certain kind of nation state.
Mm.
So to use that lens to think about the movement, the contemporary movement, is something I wanted to help people develop that and just be like, use this lens when you are looking at what's happening now.
Gotcha.
And, yeah. And so what was really incredible, you know, because you write a book, when I was writing the book, I didn't have a job. Mm. And I thought, this may be my only contribution as an academic, and maybe I need to be okay with that. It was one of the most difficult things, realizing, because I graduated in 2009 when the economy was. And there are still people like who graduated the same time. Like, there's a certain generation of us who just never got tenure track jobs because our window was destroyed.
Yeah. Right?
And the window is already really narrow.
Right. That's why I didn't finish my PhD. I stopped for comps because I was looking ahead at the prospective opportunities for me in the future, and I didn't see anything good. So I stopped.
Yeah, exactly. And I've known people who do that too. And I'm always like, that was a good, but yeah. But I also know I couldn't have stopped. Like, I was no one could have said to me. And of course there was no way of knowing. And I knew nothing about the job market. I knew nothing about, I just had questions I wanted to answer. It was that simple, right? I mean, I guess that betrays a certain amount of privilege, or I don't know what, right? It was never about economics, because I was like, this is the most, I'm like, I will be paying off loans for the rest of my life. And if I'm okay with that, then I can do this, right?
Yeah.
And I was. But what was really fascinating is, so I wrote this book as an academic contribution, and just, I wanted it to be respected. I didn't expect a lot of attention. And then when it got attention, you know, people writing reviews and people reading it who were not academics and writing about it and writing to me and saying, hey, we run we're mental health professionals. We have a library for people working through all this stuff. We're wondering, do you think your book would be an appropriate addition? But this idea that an academic book is going to be helpful for people working through what now I would call religious trauma, right? Mm-hmm. I didn't have that language at the time. And And when that happened, like that summer, I was like, if I ever do anything else, it's going to be public facing work, because there is a public out there who needs to be heard, and who needs to be and who needs resources for making sense of their experiences.
Amazing. Well, and you're still doing that. You're contributing to the field, like you're doing public facing work. I know that you work with Straight White American Jesus podcast, which is a wonderful, fantastic podcast. Mm-hmm. And there's also a recent piece of scholarship that you put out with The Revealer, titled White Women's Bodies and the Dilemma of Purity Culture Recovery, emphasizing the recovery aspect, which I found really fascinating. And you kind of already went over some of the main turning points and details and the history behind all of it. And, you know, I want to dive into this article a little bit. And something that I was wondering is, like, the promises that are made to draw youth in the U.S. to purity culture. Can you give me a little overview about, like, what is said and done to draw youth's attention towards purity culture in the U.S. like today? What's going on to, like, keep youth engaged in this movement?
Yeah. So I was just talking to my sister this weekend, and she reminded me of Irma Kim Hackett, who is a, I believe she's a clergy person who's also a writer, but she wrote, she named it Disney Princess Theology. And she wrote about it not just as sort of the work of romance, of sort of sanctifying romance. The promises of purity culture are that you can and should prepare yourself for Christian marriage. And so they've created a set of rituals around this idea. And the first being, you know, sort of a purity ring ceremony where you make a commitment to God, to your parents, right? Depends on the context, that you will not have sex until marriage, or you will maintain sexual purity. I think there's a preference, like the term sexual purity became preferred because it's so bendy, right? Mm-hmm. It means more than simply, right, you cannot have sexual intercourse, because they discovered that if they focused on sexual, and this is true, this came out in my interviews, they found that if they only focused on this thing called sexual abstinence, that people were like finding loopholes. and doing things and claiming they were still maintaining, right, their purity or whatever. So they changed it to sexual purity. You know, and one person I talked to who worked for True Love Waits, she was like, you know, we don't have to work at all to get girls to come and join into this, right? Because it works so well already with sort of the sort of misogynistic romanticization, right, of life, and saying, you know, like, hey, this is everything, you know, and really kind of couches marriage as like a form of salvation, right? And right, which is part of, you know, which is sort of how fairy tale narratives work, right? The happily ever after, and sort of, and is very explicit in putting that forward. As evangelicals have done forever, right, using elements of popular culture, things that are already very powerful narratives and symbols, and then sort of framing it as, you know, as part of one's spiritual development. Taking a purity pledge was very much part of the sort of the spiritual journey of adolescence, right, toward marriage, right, that marriage was the apotheosis of adolescence, right? So that is, right, so that was the promise.
Mm-hmm.
And, that, hey, you know, if you do all these things, right, and very, right, if you keep yourself as pure as possible and you get married, like you are, you know, you're going to be blessed with a marriage that's free of emotional strife. You are going to, you're going to have mind-blowing sex. Like, this was also, you know, this is why Christine Gardner's book was called Making Chastity Sexy, because it really is. I mean, they sort of use the promise of good sex to say, wait to have it, you know? And I think because evangelicals, you know, have become very self-conscious about being perceived as being sex negative. I mean, since the 1970s, there have been, you know, marriage manuals for evangelicals who are, you know, which are really fascinating to read and think about. So, you know, I think in many cases, it was an easy sell. But what happened is that then not being sexually active became an outsized component of Christian spirituality. And I knew that pretty early on in my research. I was like, so, you know, the whole sort of sinner to saved narrative of evangelical Christianity has become part of, is this, you know, is sort of the purity narrative. So it had sort of the thrall of romantic passion and excitement and anticipation, right? But also the thrall of spiritual salvation, right? And like, that's such a powerful thing. And just sort of in terms of its affective, you know, weight. And yeah, it just in the 90s and 2000s just, you know, kind of grew into a cultural force.
You know, the article is really interesting in the fact that it talks about backlashes to purity movement. And there is like this sort of network, it feels like, of like former evangelicals that have, you know, begun speaking out very forcefully, making their own podcasts about, you know, ex-evangelical, you know, outreach, writers, and there's a lot of, you know, social media campaigns on large platforms by ex-evangelicals. Tell me a little bit about the backlash to purity culture that you're noticing.
Yeah. So it's really fascinating, but I, you know, it wasn't until, so my book came out in 2015. And so I have been trying to what I've been doing, I think since 2013 is tracing the backlash and seeing where it's coming from. And one of the more prominent people for this group we now call ex-evangelicals to start this, two of them were Rachel Held Evans. And if your listeners know who she is, right, the anniversary of her death just passed.
She's an amazing.
Yeah. So both her and Sarah Bessie. And people like Elizabeth Esther, right? These white evangelical women who were sort of on the border of it and raising questions, like coming from a feminist perspective. But before that, there were Black women like Dr. Brittany Cooper, who grew up in a white Southern Baptist context and in Mississippi, and who also was totally pulled into True Love Waits because she saw that's what the white girls were doing. And she was very, she knew she wanted to graduate high school. She wanted to go to college and to graduate school. Like, she knew she was an intellectual at a very young age, and she wanted to make sure she had every opportunity. And so when she saw that this purity thing was something that the white girls in her school were doing, she was like, yep, that's me. I'm going to do that. I'm just going to, you know, forget about all this other stuff. And she has a gorgeous essay called Grown Woman Theology, where in the midst of this, her grandmother sits her down and is like, let me tell you a couple things. Right. And so I think that, and so that conversation was happening even before white ex-evangelicals were talking or having this conversation. But what really kind of got things into the public was not an evangelical, but a young Mormon woman named Elizabeth Smart, who people will recall. She was the 13-year-old who was abducted in Salt Lake City, Utah, by a self-proclaimed Mormon prophet. She was She was held captive for 9 months. She was raped. And in 2013, she talked about, she now runs an organization advocating for people who come out of sex trafficking, right? Helping people work through those experiences. But she said that when she was being held captive, she remembered what she learned in her church about sex. And that is, when you have sex before you're married, you're like a chewed up piece of gum. And no one wants a chewed up piece of gum. So this was her response after she was assaulted, right? And she said, you know, this is one of the reasons why I didn't really make an effort to escape, because she really felt like the value of her life held nothing, right? You know, and she's right. And she is a good Mormon woman, right? She is still. But when she said that, evangelicals were like it just sort of hit the evangelical consciousness, and especially people on the edges of it. So people like Rachel and Sarah and Elizabeth Esther were like, oh, yep. And so that's really when the conversation got started. But since then, it has been a never ending like flood. Like, I just stop being able to keep up. There was a time when I was trying to like download and organize any blog post, article, or whatever. But it just became so much. And I was like, I don't know what to do. So in 2016 is, I think, when the nomenclature of evangelical gets introduced, right? And right away, I was asking people like Chrissy Stroop and like Chastain, like, hey, you know, my hunch is that this is, you know, a pretty, like, you know, like the overlap here in the Venn diagram is almost exact in terms of people talking about problems with purity culture and this evangelical thing. And that's right. And that's certainly what has borne out in my research. Right. And so part of my research is thinking about this thing called the group we're calling evangelicals, who they are, you know, why people leave, what happens after that, you know, and sort of the kinds of things that people have to sort through. I sort of think of, like, you know, evangelicalism as this big umbrella, and then there's all these little things, and purity culture is a big part of that. You know, it's sort of the rain hat that you wear under the umbrella, I guess.
Yeah. You know, another aspect that I think is under-discussed with regards to purity culture is the racism aspect, which I think that your article does a really good job of shining a light on, because I had never really put that together myself. Whenever I've read about purity culture and evangelical movements, I never thought really about racism. So there's this aspect where, like, the white Protestant women are sort of put on a sexually pure pedestal as models of piety, and the inherent racism in that. And it was called out by, like, Sojourner Truth and others in your article, which I thought was really interesting. Tell me a little bit more about the racism and white supremacy aspect and how it's disguised as Christian virtue, because I thought that was so fascinating.
Yeah. Right. And again, this is an argument you can take back to the 19th century. And the way that, you know, the gendered, the ideal, this notion of ideal womanhood was established as a racial ideal, and one that only white women could access or claim as their own, right? Now, of course, ideals are never reflections of what is real. And of course, this was at a time when there needed to be a sense of, you know, because even in the North, you know, where you're going to have an abolitionist movement, there were a lot of white people who were not abolitionists and needed to somehow make slavery palatable, right? Whereas in the South, you have people who are just all out ready to fight for it, right? And one of the ways of making it palatable was to idealize white womanhood as being valuable to the nation, right? And there was a lot of sort of nationalistic imagery and narration around the role of white womanhood that basically said, so if in contemporary purity culture, we talk about the white American family, right? The white evangelical family in the 19th century, it was white women, okay? So playing the same role, but this is the emphasis, because again, white women were then perceived as playing a role in nation building, right? When in fact, the nation was being built by people whose bodies were being exploited. Right. And so so we need to sort of think about the context in which these ideals around womanhood were developed. And they were developed to counterbalance the cruelty of slavery. Right. And to sort of provide like a, you know, again, like a screen. Right. You know, here's a screen that we can project anything we want to. And don't look over here. Mm-hmm. Right. Oh, and look at these white women who are doing this. Right. And who were doing these things. And so the connection, so sexual purity was always developed to be something that could be ascribed to white women, right? And so I sort of think about white womanhood as being a set of benefits, a set of risks, a set of constraints, that white women can enter into whenever they want, if they need to assert their authority.
Gotcha. Okay?
And so white women, this is how white women then perform, can perform racial power. And over the last few years, we've seen sort of some epic examples of that. And this goes back to the idea of connecting sexual purity to white womanhood, because sexual purity means that you are morally above reproach, right? And so I think that if we understand white racial identity as something we are socialized into, right? Our gender identities are things we are socialized into, then this is one of the ways that white girls are socialized, right? Or can be socialized. And so that is the through line I am currently trying to trace, right? And thinking about, and that the next step in that through line is racial terror lynchings. And this is again where we see the prominence of white women's sexual purity, right? That needs to be defended at all costs. And it was, right? It was part of what Ida B. Wells called the threadbare lie, right? That you have these sexually pure and vulnerable white women and these dangerous Black men, right? Who are bent on, attacking white women. And that was the vast majority of the reason why lynchings happened, right? And why Black men were lynched, right? It was, you know, which was the largest number of people who experienced that. And there's, right, and that's a whole, right? So that's a whole chapter of my next book, right?
Nice.
Piecing this apart as, you know, So the article I wrote for The Revealer was trying to think about, you know, how does white womanhood show up in what I call this post-purity moment, right? And the thing is, like, you know, second wave feminism is the idea that, you know, women are individuals who are distinctly different from men, have a unique set of needs, but who have been overlooked, and many other things, right, who deserve equality. But it never offered a really good way of thinking about racial identity. And so we know from the history of second wave feminism that a lot of women, including women of color and queer women, were not really part of the set, you know, did not feel like they could be a part of it, right? And so a lot of the post-purity rhetoric that's being used is very second wave feminist and drawing on, I think in some cases in very smart ways, on notions of religious trauma and religious abuse. But for me, like one of the hardest things for me to read is when people are doing what seems to be really good feminist analysis, and then they don't know how to think about race and racial identity, because it's intellectually, it's incomplete, but it's also, it also perpetuates a kind of harm and reinforces this idea, right, that white women don't have, we don't have to think about our racial identity. And this is for me, and this is part of my own thinking, in that, I mean, my master's degree was on whiteness and feminist theology. I took a course in seminary called the Psychology of Whiteness and Feminist Theology that just changed. I was also studying womanist theology and Black liberationist theology for the first time. And my response to that was to start thinking about white racial identity. And then when I started working on evangelical purity culture, I focused more on adolescent sexuality and did a little bit on race, not as much as I feel like I failed in my first book to really address race appropriately, that it needed to be more part of the major through line than it was, which is why for this project, I'm really highlighting it and saying and asking the question, how is evangelical purity culture a project in white racial dominance?
Gotcha. You know, you do so much already with regards to public scholarship, public facing work, you know, Straight White American Jesus podcast, writing for The Revealer, your After Purity project, which I will link in the show notes. I'm wondering about your experience so far with the Sacred Rights cohort that you're a part of, and like what you're getting out of it and what you're enjoying about the process of going through these trainings of being a specifically public facing scholar and getting your work out there for the greater public. What are you enjoying about the process so far?
Yeah. Well, it's just such a great group of people. And it was so wild because I'd applied many times before I got in. And now like the thanks, I'm like, oh yeah, I finally got it. But I knew, I was like, well, this is what I'm already doing. And I want to make sure I have all the tools I need to do it as well as I can. Right. Mm-hmm. So that I'm not, you know, I had been working with, you know, with Brett on the article.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh wait, he's in charge of this cohort. That's, you know, and so, but he's an amazing editor and it's been delightful to work with him. Susanna, I've known for a couple of years now. Our research, you know, intersects in a lot of ways. And it's really interesting because I have been wanting, it's good to set time aside. It's good for me to set time aside to think intentionally about what public scholarship means to me, mm-hmm. and what kind of things I want to offer, right? Because it's about making a lot of different choices, right? It was easy for me to make the choice that yes, this needs to be public facing work, right? But that can mean a lot of different things. And so our group, right, one of the things that I think is just marvelous about Sacred Rights, and I think one of the things that's changing and we're doing a better job at in academia, at least among within religious studies, is that we bring together people at different stages of their careers, right? So there's graduate students, there's junior scholars, right? We got, you know, we're celebrating people who just are defending their dissertations. And we have people who've been teaching for 20, 30 years, right?
Yeah.
And so seeing, and so being able to sort of hear people, and like someone did, you know, Orit, if I, I don't know if she wants, she may not want me to talk about this, but she's been like, I don't know how to do this. And then she wrote something really important about, like some anti-gay stuff at a Jewish university. And she's like, I wrote this up, and, you know, we were in a small group talking about it. And I was like, this is a really good Twitter thread.
Mm-hmm.
It's informative, right? It's clear, it's direct. And it's just giving you information. Like, this is it, right? This is public school. And just sort of being able to help people realize, like, you have a contribution to make, right? This is what I read Twitter for, to read these things, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is, as much as we can say about social media, right, it's still helpful for that kind of stuff. And so I get excited, and I get excited when other people kind of are discovering what they can do, and just being like, look, we don't have to be stuck in a world of other academics where all of our energy goes towards our, you know, monitoring our own ego crises, right? Because that's so much of what it is. And so when you're doing public facing work, for me, a lot of that goes away. I imagine everyone has different experiences, because I'm like, I'm not worried about people thinking I'm smart, or about having to like be so niche in my argumentation. Like, I'm more interested in how do we communicate with clarity? How do we offer people resources for making sense of some of the biggest questions we have right now? And just helping people, you know, kind of work through like some really, really difficult things, right? Because for me, like when there's, you know, when I'm feeling in crisis over something, whether that's sort of like the end of Roe v. Wade or the pandemic, right? I get reassurance when I go to history and mm-hmm. I learn about, you know, the pandemic of 1918, right? And so on and so forth. So I love it when people realize that they have something to offer. And yeah.
Well, Dr. Sarah Mosliner, I have loved learning about your work, your fascinating life story, your book Virgin Nation, your recent article White Women's Bodies and the Dilemma of Purity Culture Recovery from the Revealer. We have covered so much ground. I am so grateful to you for your time and your energy in this conversation. Where can people find you if they want to know more about what you do and, you know, get in touch maybe and follow along?
Yeah. So the best place, so I am still pretty active on Twitter. And so you can find me at Mosliner Sarah, because I didn't know how to make a Twitter handle. But I am the After Purity Project on Twitter. The other thing, so I'm starting to write more on Substack. So you can find me on the After Purity Project on Substack.
Substack. They have a great podcasting platform too over there.
Yeah. So that's the best place to go to find me.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure having you today.
Thank you.